Welcome to the world today. My name is Frank Weltner. I am the librarian for JewWatch, the largest compendium of information about Jewish organizations and news on the internet today. In addition, I am the librarian and archivist for a new website, www.americanussr.com, which is already the largest compendium of history concerning the negative aspects of the United States of America, which the CIA, FBI, the presidency, the Congress, and all other agencies of the United States want you to know nothing about. You're listening to The World Today. My name is Frank Weltner, and today is January the 21st, 2011. In our first story today, the phrase "enemy within" brings to my mind the image of a shadowy spy stealing military secrets. That was the case for Israeli master spy Jonathan Pollard, who was jailed for 1980s espionage that compromised U.S. Cold War strategy. The phrase also describes those involved in a form of psyops that is not easily detected. For instance, the well-timed release of diplomatic cables by WikiLeaks displaced reports of Israeli obstinacy in peace talks with reports of a need for war within Iran. That operation relied on editors at four major newspapers chosen by WikiLeaks to manage the releases. Despite the delight at their impact voiced by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, mainstream media failed to mention the possibility of undisclosed bias by those who chose what to release and when. The bias of the New York Times is well known. Less clear is the role of Ian Katz, deputy editor of The Guardian in London, and executive editor is Sylvie Kaufman at Le Monde in Paris. The geopolitical success of the WikiLeaks operation suggests an enemy within. Israeli duplicity often operates through what U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates describes as the people in between. When waging unconventional warfare, those people are the most dangerous combatants, particularly those operatives in the mainstream media. For systems of governance reliant on informed consent, nothing could be more perilous than the people in between. They routinely target media, freedom's greatest vulnerability, as a means for displacing facts with what a targeted populace can be deceived to believe. How old is this duplicity? How long have false beliefs been used to manipulate behavior? Modern technology, particularly media, enables deception on a global scale. Between the American populace and the facts they require to protect their freedom, that's where this enemy within embeds its operatives. The false intelligence claiming Iraqi WMD was a people-in-between operation. Judith Miller at the New York Times led us on a steady diet of front-page news that we now know was fixed around Israeli goals, promoted by Ahmad Chalabi, a London-based Iraqi expatriate who, like Israel, sought regime change in Iraq. Pentagon insider Richard Perle developed Chalabi over two decades. A Jewish Zionist with dual loyalties, Perle has long been a strategically well-placed person in between. Miller left the Times and joined Fox News and then Newsmax. Yet the impact of complicit media pales in comparison to the enemy within that brought the U.S. economy to its knees and undermined national security at its financial core. Embedded inside were the banks and their operatives. The most devastating in this chronicle of enemies is the most difficult to see, as with other in-between operations. This, too, succeeds by displacing facts with false beliefs. Only in this case, those beliefs were embedded in education and over decades worked their way into law. Known as the Washington Consensus, this widely shared perspective shapes economic policy worldwide. At the heart of this generally accepted truth is found the belief that money should be accountable only to itself. In this mindset, financial freedom is an article of faith. Instead of the civil rights refrain, "Let my people go," its proponents insist, "Let my money go." Allow money the freedom to work its will worldwide and everything will work out fine. Which, of course, we found is totally untrue, and just the opposite seems to be the case. That shared belief that money should be allowed to do its thing works in between in the same way that Jonathan Pollard undermined national security, the same way that WikiLeaks shifted attention to Iran, and the same way that Judith Miller induced us to war in Iraq. Only in this case, a false belief has been so thoroughly internalized that it is difficult to see because the shared mindset has become that with which we have been educated to do our seeing. As a kind of aside, I'd like to mention at this point that it's really strange how almost everything of any import in our world, especially anything that has gone awry, has something to do with Israel and with the Jewish people. And here again, we find this to be true. We live in a global Sanhedrin. The World Bank and its International Monetary Fund are the primary apostles of this consensus faith. The World Trade Organization, WTO, now seeks to take this belief to global scale by enforcing unrestricted free trade not only in goods and services but also financial capital. The WTO operates like a global Sanhedrin, akin to a Jewish High Council, accountable only to itself. What's now emerging as a global enemy within is a finance-guided form of transnational governance, marketed as free trade, but accountable only to itself. That self traces its origins to an internalized mindset in which financial freedom serves by consensus as a proxy for personal freedom. That mindset was decades in the making. This modern-day mindset warfare is being waged by an enemy that is truly within. Fast globalizing financial forces now seduce us into freely embracing the very forces that destroy us and undermine our freedom. By waging internal war on us from the inside out, the originators of this money myopic mindset have dismantled the U.S. economy, enabled vast financial pillaging, and induced us to physical ruin. Those wielding this weaponry operate from our internal shadows as the Zionist entity within. I ask myself, how in the world could my country be so ignorant as to allow the Zionists within to control our government through banking and through propaganda, which is wielded on Madison Avenue? Propaganda that is fed to us through each newspaper, through each magazine, through each film. We're spin artists who are interested in the promulgation of Israeli ideals, which include banking ruination of the United States if necessary, to produce wars in the Middle East for Israel, to produce wars anywhere that Israel wants them, so that money can be given to the banks in form of interest for loans to America and to other nations to support these wars, so that the banks themselves continue to be pumped with this interest from loans that are necessary to further these wars, so that the money itself can not only run through the banks, but run through the veins of Israel as it begins to eventually and permanently rid itself of the Palestinians who were there before these Europeans invaded that area and began to effect their genocide against them. And so the enemy within continues to worm its way destructively through the heart of the United States, England, Europe, Australia, Israel, and the Arab countries in the Middle East, where Mossad and CIA agents abound, and where their operatives are at work eating the heart out of each of those countries. Soon the United States may be so crippled that it will never recover. And then we have to ask ourselves, what will the enemy within do then? Will they move en masse to China, where the money is, so they can continue to suck it dry? Well, once you're a corpse, you're dry. And that's just the way that it is. But China, newly pregnant with the unborn baby of America's industries that have been migrated there by the banks, who have sold them to the Chinese people and the Chinese army in order to remove them from the United States and further deplete America's power. China is ready to give birth to a new baby, which will be a new world order that is fashioned in its image and not in ours. And the pattern has always been that the Jews move to the country that has the money and the banks, and the Jewish banks are moving to Israel. The Jewish people will be moving with it. Many of them will stay in Europe and the United States, but a large number of them, those that want to make money, will go to China and will begin to do the same thing to its government that they've done to our governments, to destroy them from within, to tax them for wars fought for Israel, and to defy the will of the people of China and other countries where the Jewish people live, in order to fulfill the sole will of the Jewish people themselves. And along with it, of course, the Zionist will. In Haiti, former dictator Jean-Claude Duvalier told Haitians that he returned after 25 years in exile to participate in the post-earthquake reconstruction of his homeland, and that he was ready to face persecution for alleged crimes during his administration. In his first public comment since his shocking return to Haiti, the ousted strongman known as Baby Doc spoke in a faint voice and did not take questions, leaving that to three American consultants, including former U.S. Congressman and presidential candidate Bob Barr, and one of his Haitian lawyers. Duvalier said the return was timed to coincide with the one-year anniversary of the January 12th earthquake. When I made the decision to come back to Haiti to commemorate this sad anniversary with you in our country, I was ready for any kind of persecution, Duvalier said in a faint voice. But I believe that the desire to participate by your side in this collaboration for the national reconstruction far outweighs any harassment I could face. After several restaurants and hotels refused to host his speech, Duvalier spoke sitting at a long wooden table in a rented guest house in the hills above Port-au-Prince. He faced a jostling throng of cameras and reporters, mostly Haitians. The 59-year-old former leader who ruled Haiti from 71 to 86, through terror and the regime he inherited from his father, returned this week to the shattered nation. He soon found himself facing an investigation by a Haitian court for corruption, embezzlement, torture, arbitrary imprisonment, crimes against humanity, and other allegations. His motives for returning have been a source of debate and confusion. Some believe he had a desire to unlock Swiss bank accounts that contained the last remnants of his squandered fortune. Others speculate that he is gravely ill or that he is a pawn in someone else's game. Haiti's current president, the United States, or France to influence Haiti's current electoral crisis. Duvalier did not address any of those topics other than to say it was his choice to return. He appeared to be in perfect health, slurring his speech at times in a near whisper, apparently unable to move his neck and walking with a shuffle. Much of his speech was a throwback to earlier times. He spoke in French, the colonial language used by presidents, until after his ouster, dropping in only occasional words of Haitian Creole. He referred to his arrival at François Duvalier International Airport, which is named after his father. It is now Toussaint Louverture International Airport, named for the leader of Haiti's late 18th century revolution. About Haiti's past, Duvalier expressed sympathy primarily for his partisans who he killed, burned, grilled, and tortured. The Haitian slang term for placing a tire on someone's neck and setting it on fire, les brons, or who lost their property in revenge against his regime following his ouster. As for those tortured who'd followed me, imprisoned, killed, or exiled under his rule, he offered my profound sadness toward my countrymen who considered themselves rightly to have been victims of my government. He ended with a declaration imitating Martin Luther King, in which he envisioned a day when all Haiti's children, men and women, old and young, rich and poor, from the interior and from the diaspora, can march hand in hand without exclusion to participate together in Haiti's rebirth. As he shuffled off, the Americans who came with him, Barr, longtime Duvalier family advisor and attorney Ed Marger, and Snellville, Georgia attorney Mike Puglisi, arrived with Haitian lawyer Ronald Jarget to take questions while a band waving Duvalier's red and black party flag played outside. Bob Barr called Duvalier's speech profoundly moving. Marger, who handled most of the queries, said they were there to help Duvalier collect undelivered reconstruction funds promised by the United States and other countries at the March 31, 2010 UN Donors Conference. He said Duvalier could manage more effectively than former U.S. President Bill Clinton and distribute them more justly than current Haitian President René Préval. The men said they would be paid if Duvalier is able to collect those funds. So there you have it. Duvalier has returned to Haiti, something very startling, willing to face the music for torture and terror, etc., and to collect the money that the United States under Clinton's charity, to collect the money and to help distribute it, because he claims he can do it better than the president that's there today. People are wondering, is he there because of the United States CIA? Is he there because of French intelligence that wants to use him to gain influence again in Haiti, which it was kicked out of? Of course, America's been kicked out more than France. France and America do a kind of Haitian dance where they go in and out of the island trying to take over its government and exploit its natural resources. And as a result of all of our activities there, of course, our major cities in certain areas have filled up with Haitians who we allow in as rewards for Haiti allowing us to go down there and to exploit that country. And many people down there remember Duvalier's horrible regime, how he would place tires around people's necks and burn them. In fact, when he left them, many of his followers had tires placed around their necks, and they died in the same manner with a Haitian necktie party. And I kind of feel that the United States has something to do with this. I mean, here we have Bob Barr there. Why would an ex-United States legislator, Bob Barr, be there? What's he doing there? What are these other Americans doing there if the United States isn't involved in this? I mean, this is kind of crazy. You got this Bob Barr, who was a longtime family advisor, and then another longtime advisor and attorney, Ed Marger, and of Snellville, Georgia, and Mike Puglisi. I mean, these people are, you know, they're very closely allied with the elites in America. They've been very useful to the elites. They have helped the elites on many, many occasions. And here they are surrounding Duvalier as he returns to Haiti. Now, there's something going on here. These people also know President Bill Clinton and President Obama and President Bush, all of whom have been knee-deep in Haitian politics over the last 20, 30 years. So here it looks as though we have the United States and France trying to get back into Haiti, trying to manipulate things so that whatever happens, there will be money coming to France and to America, and total exploitation of the people. Their minerals stolen through business deals. And many of their people shipped to America and to France to work in factories at very cheap wages, because basically that's generally what happens to them when they become immigrants. They are, first of all, black immigrants, very deeply black. And even though they're nice people, almost all of them, Americans and French are very prejudiced against black people. And the one reason they want them to work in factories is to keep salary levels down, not only for the Haitians, but for the other people that work next to the Haitians. And if the people next to the Haitians don't take less wages for working with a Haitian, then, well, they can always be replaced by another Haitian. That's the name of this immigrant game. It's called racism and genocide, pure and simple, and it's the American way of doing business. It's the way America always did business, such as the settlers moving west and killing out one tribe after the other, sending the troops first, who would build a fort and soften up the Indian population, demoralize them, shoot them up, make them to move into some of the rockiest lands where there were very few resources for them to live off of, so that the settlers could come in and take the best parts. It was kind of Zionist, actually. You know, here we were shuffling these people off and treating these Sioux Indians as though they were Palestinians, and you know, bombing them with cannon and with bullets, until finally they just gave up and sat on the reservations and did nothing. And we brought them food, and we brought them cigarettes, and we kept them there and began to teach them our language and to train them not to speak their own language, and gave them a real head trip to change everything they were doing for their entire history and embrace European ideas, embrace Christianity, the European religion, and to defy their ancient gods and ministers, so that they would become truly the mirror of the United States of America as it is today in most of the big cities. So their culture and their distinguished aspects were stolen from them. And so now they become kind of a look-alike American with an Indian face, lots of wrinkles, large, semi-wild eyes, reminiscent of the Mongolian background from which they came. And same thing's happening in Haiti. The Americans are down there treating them like Palestinians, and so are the French. And here comes Duvalier as a kind of red herring or a piece of fresh red beef thrown onto the smorgasbord of goodies that America and France are going to take with them as they finish with that country. They're shipping things there to try to help the people build houses and so forth. But really, they want control of the country because there's vast wealth there. Doesn't look like vast wealth to many people, but there are minerals there. And there's also the drug trade, tremendous drug trade. And with the drug trade comes banking profit. And with banking profit comes money for the American government, the CIA, and for constant, irredeemable warfare. On Friday, U.S. District Judge Joan Lefkow sentenced John Burge to 4.5 years in prison for perjury and obstruction of justice in connection with the systematic torture of African-American suspects in the 1970s and 1980s, a distance of time that spans 2 decades. The sentencing of the former police commander closes an ugly chapter of Chicago's history, but does not in itself foster healing between American African-American community and the Chicago Police Department. Anthony Holmes, one of Burge's accusers, raised the question that needs to be answered before any real healing can take place. "Why did you do this? You are supposed to be the law," Holmes asked, reading from a written statement during the sentencing hearing. But Burge didn't give an answer. It is clear from the long line of African-American suspects who accused Burge of torture and were later exonerated that race and status had a lot to do with the abuse. Most people don't want to talk about that. Worse yet, while there was enough evidence of the abuse to result in Burge's firing, he was allowed to retire to Florida and enjoy a hefty pension for years. That alone ought to have been enough to trigger a federal investigation. The police brutality that Burge is accused of engaging in was so egregious. The case is often cited by human rights activists as proof that America has its own issues when it comes to human rights violations. Because the statute of limitations on torture cases had expired, the feds could prosecute Burge only for lying and obstruction of justice. So while Burge's sentencing reflects a measure of justice, there was no atonement. Burge was as unrepentant during his sentencing hearing as he was during his trial. Although he apologized for the disrepute that the charges had brought on the Chicago Police Department, he did not admit the abuse nor apologize for it. He should have apologized to the alleged victims of the torture after admitting what he had done, but he didn't. He should have apologized to the families who were forced to wait, in some instances for decades, for the truth to come out after their loved ones allegedly were shocked and beaten into making false confessions. And he should have apologized to the city's taxpayers for the millions of dollars it has had to shell out to settle police abuse cases. But instead of getting an apology, alleged victims and their families saw Burge's supporters rally around him in the same way the Fraternal Order of Police rallied around him when he was fired from the police department amid allegations of police brutality. Well, what else would you expect, ladies and gentlemen? I mean, this is America, the land of constant torture, torture for hundreds and hundreds of years, not only in warfare, but in police departments. Torture. Torture is an American favorite. In 1993, the FOP was forced to cancel its participation in the Southside St. Patrick's Day parade, and after plans to honor Burge on a parade float created a firestorm of protests. That's how hated the man is. Under different leadership in 2008, the FOP voted to foot the entire legal bill for Burge's defense on federal charges tied to allegations that he tortured suspects. Last week, Burge's Fraternity of Police, FOP supporters, pleaded for leniency, citing the former police commander's meritorious military service. They also depicted Burge as a great police officer. Despite the allegations made against him by African-American suspects, Burge told the court that he's not a racist and that some of his closest friends in the police department were African-American. Well, that may be true, but the abuse that allegedly occurred in Area 2 headquarters under Burge's command was racist. There was no indication that non-black suspects were shocked into signing false confessions, or that their rights were trampled on in the same way. The level of abuse Burge is accused of inflicting on black suspects suggests that his former top-ranking official, that this former top-ranking official doesn't see black suspects as deserving the same standard of justice as other suspects, such as non-black suspects, who showed no indication whatsoever of having been shocked into signing false confessions under torture and under shocks from the electric shock machines that he had. Until the Chicago Police Department openly tackles this issue, it will clearly be impossible to restore the trust Burge destroyed. Well, I think that's interesting, because there's never been any trust in the Chicago Police Department. I mean, I've been around a long time, and let me assure you, there has never, ever been a year in which there was trust in the Chicago Police Department. I mean, that just doesn't happen. I mean, these guys are sailing around the streets at high speeds in their cop cars with their billy clubs twirling as soon as they get out. You know, their guns sparkling, shoving people around, grabbing them by the lapels, lifting them in the air, saying, "Hey, buddy, what are you doing here?" And on and on and on. And look at the convention in Chicago when the Chicago Seven were there, and there was a police riot out in front of the Republican National Convention. I mean, look at what was going on there. Well, actually, it was a Democratic convention. You remember, it was Mayor Daley, you know, the Mr. Democrat. And these kids went to this park in order to have their rallies. And the police wouldn't even leave them alone there. They came running through the park with their billy clubs smashing heads. This is a fascist American city. And because people went there, because it was the second city in the country, the second largest, the police force there was able to use their racism and to express themselves creatively by cracking the heads of these kids. Now, a lot of those kids were white that were there during that protest. Remember, there was Jerry Rubin and that type were there. I mean, these kids were there expressing their belief that America was a free country, and they were rewarded with imprisonment, with torture, being spit on, beaten up, and the American people were totally appalled by it, because for the first time they were able to see this type of torture unleashed upon college students, who are the most innocent students of all, because they're in their formative years, 18 to 22 years old, out there trying to do the right thing. They were protesting the war in Vietnam, which was started with the fake Gulf of Tonkin resolution when the Gulf of Tonkin hadn't even happened. And here's the fuzz out there. The great Chicago Police Department beating their heads and spraying them with all sorts of chemicals like pepper spray, so they would be screaming in pain because their eyes hurt so badly, spraying them with tear gas, stomping on them, throwing them into prisons that were overcrowded to the max, where people were throwing up on each other, terrifying them to death, a typical American torture experience, the type of which has been used over and over again since I was born. People just don't understand the depth of darkness that's in the heart of America, because they see this BS in the movies and on television and on radio about how wonderful this country is, and yet the people that own it and that run it are the same people that founded and ran the Soviet Union, so that it ran just like Chicago for many, many decades, except that they were actually killing people, pulling them out of their houses and shooting them in the back of the head. The Jews who owned it, the Jews who bought the revolution using banking money in New York, went over there with 350 Jewish people to run it. They killed, first of all, the Tsar's family. Then they killed the police, the military people. They began to murder everybody, the priests, etc., you name it. and pulling them out of their houses, taking them outside of town to a dark place, putting a bullet in the back of their head, burying them in secret graves where no one would ever see them again. And then they started the gulag system when they began to say, well, maybe we shouldn't kill them. Why don't we put them into a gulag? So the Jews were running these gulags all over Siberia, feeding people very few calories and treating them very abusively. Same way they treat the Palestinians today. Same people, same problem. They're sick in the head and they don't care who they abuse. Yeah, same as Mukasey and Chertoff going after me for publishing the truth about what they did in Russia and in Lebanon when they murdered people. Israel and the red communists who came from New York and who now have gone back to New York and are sitting around eating Russian rhubarb pie in fine restaurants and speaking Russian in Brighton Beach, New York, because their relatives came from there. Their relatives came from Russia to New York because they were communists and they got kicked out. Then they went back to Russia to murder the Christians, to exact revenge. And now they're back in New York laughing their rear ends off and receiving Social Security money from the United States because they're a special group. Yeah, they're a special group, all right. They're the banking group. They're the group that abuses the entire world. At any rate, here we have this policeman. Chief of Police of Chicago, Burge. The craziest thing, this was in the Chicago Times. The person writing it is talking about the how great Chicago police people are. And then the person that doesn't sentence him for too much was Joan Lefkow. Now, she's the one that sentenced Matt Hale to 40 years in prison, and he hadn't done a darn thing. The FBI had put a thug in his organization, had secreted him in to penetrate it. And the way they did it was they got this thug came up and they got some other thugs to start beating on Matt Hale and his people at a protest. So this guy comes up with his people and chases them away. And then Matt Hale so happy he talks with him and makes him part of the organization. The guy is in there to spy on him, and the guy tells the judge that he would call Matt Hale every day and say, I want to kill the judge. That's Judge Lefkow who made this decision. And Matt Hale would say, no, I don't do that sort of thing. Get away from me. Finally said, well, you do what you want, but don't involve me in whatever you do. And with that, instead of sentencing the guy who kept saying he was going to kill the judge, no, she sentences Matt Hale to get this 40 years in prison. He hadn't done anything, nothing, except get screwed over by an FBI informant. The typical American justice deal where the people who are government dissidents get screwed by the fascist state of the freak show in Washington, D.C. So here she is. She gives that man 40 years in prison for doing nothing. Nothing. And here she has this guy who tortures African Americans for at least two decades. At least two decades. And in the 60s, I believe he was the one that was also in charge of beating up on those kids out there at Lincoln Park during the Democratic Convention that was televised to everybody. And here we have Chicago Sun-Times, which used to be, I don't know what it is now, but it's kind of a Republican newspaper. And they're saying that the police department had a wonderful reputation before Burge, you know, destroyed it. And but you know what? How could it? This was the town that had they had all those mafia people going, you know, like Meyer Lansky, Meyer Lansky, and the guy that died of syphilis. What was his name? Back in the '20s. You know, with the Valentine's Day Massacre. I'll have to look it up here on a Google. Valentine's Day Massacre. Get the guy's name. They got him in jail because he hadn't reported his income tax properly. And Al Capone, 1929. It was a sensation. Well, anyway, the Chicago police were wrapped up with the mafia, like Al Capone. He was in the Sicilian mafia, and then you had the Jewish mafia up there with Meyer Lansky, who was able to get the state of Illinois for Bobby Kennedy's election, through his criminality. They had to bring the feds in to stop all of this, this gun running and booze running by Al Capone. So, please, sometimes, who are you kidding that Chicago's police force has a dignified history? Mr. Mayor, his name was Daley, by the way, he just took a job with Obama, Obama made him a stooge up there in the freak show in the White House. And at any rate, there is no dignity to the police force in Chicago. It's a freak show. And if you don't think that people in Chicago are racist, I don't know where you've been. You've been hiding your head in the soil. That's all there is to it. In New York, MSNBC host Keith Olbermann announced that he's leaving the network and has taped his last Countdown show. MSNBC issued a statement that it had ended its contract with the controversial host with no further explanation. Olbermann hosted the network's most popular show, but his combative liberal opinions often made him a target of critics. Olbermann did not explain why he was leaving. MSNBC thanks Keith for his integral role in MSNBC's success, and we wish him well in his future endeavors, the network said. I love that when a company wishes people well after they fire them. We fired you, and we wish you well. Right. Well, if you wished him so well, why didn't you keep him on? A spokesman said Phil Griffin, MSNBC's president, would not comment on Olbermann's exit. No, he doesn't want to get fired. Spokesman Jeremy Gaines would say only that the acquisition of NBC Universal by Comcast, which received regulatory approval this week, had nothing to do with the decision. Olbermann was suspended without pay from the network for 2 days in November for donating to 3 Democratic candidates, which violated NBC News policy on political donations. Olbermann complained that he was being punished for mistakenly violating an inconsistently applied rule that he had known nothing about. The host apologized to fans, but not to the network. Olbermann, before leaving the show with a final signature toss of his script toward the camera, thanked his audience for sticking with him and read a James Thurber poem. This may be the only television program where the host was much more in awe of the audience than vice versa, he said. Olbermann thanked a series of people, including the late Tim Russert, but pointedly not Griffin, or NBC News President Steve Kappas. Olbermann's primetime show is the network's top-rated. His evolution from a humorous look at the day's headlines into a pointedly liberal show in the last half of George W. Bush's administration led MSNBC to largely shift the tone of the network in his direction, with the hirings of Rachel Maddow and Lawrence O'Donnell in prime time. So there you have it. Keith Olbermann's out. Why? He had the Countdown show. And he was very abrasive, and I thought he was very interesting. I liked him. There was a while when I'd watch him almost every day when he was doing a countdown to the end of the Bush administration with all of its stupidity. Boy, there was a jerk of a president. Oh, my God. What that man did to this country is just unreal. I mean, the country was almost at the point where we'd never have to be in debt ever again. And by the time he was done, we were in a depression, and we'll never get out of debt. The man was a disaster who should be in a jail right now. He started a war on lies. He overspent money. And the guy was just, he was just incredible. Absolutely incredible. What a jerk. I have a friend who thought he was really great. And I just don't understand how he could feel that way. But strange things happen in this world. Now, you talk about a decadent and corrupt America. Rahm Emanuel, a Jew from Chicago who is very good friends with Obama and was his chief of staff, has now tapped his super agent brother Ares Hollywood Money Network big time in his bid to become Chicago mayor, gobbling up 5- and 6-figure checks from mostly Jews, the likes of Steve Spielberg, West Wing creator Aaron Sorkin, DreamWorks mogul Jeffrey Katzenberg, and the Napster founder played by Justin Timberlake in the Social Network. But Emanuel's stunning multi-million dollar haul wasn't limited to the bright lights of Sunset Strip. It also included huge payouts from CEOs and hedge fund managers who totally screwed the American people and those in places like Iceland and Ireland and England. Across from New York to Silicon Valley, Apple CEO Steve Jobs, Donald Trump, and former Secretary Treasurer of the Treasury, Robert Rubin. Emanuel's shop announced Thursday afternoon it had collected $11.7 million, including $1.1 million already in the former congressman's funds, since unofficially launching his campaign in October. That total almost identical to what Governor Pat Quinn spent in a statewide gubernatorial race this fall, puts Emanuel in a strong position as he tries to replace longtime Mayor Richard M. Daley, who was hired away from Chicago by Obama, so his buddy Emanuel could be mayor. Isn't that nice? So you get to manipulate elections that way when you come to be a big sugar daddy in America. Emanuel already has spent $2.2 million on friend David Axelrod, Chicago-based communications firm, to produce commercials that remind Chicago voters that the man who lived in D.C. for the past year and a half is still a native Jewish son. All state candidates in Illinois had to submit their financial disclosures by midnight for fundraising conducted before January 1st. Emanuel benefited greatly from a lag time in the implementation of newly elected campaign finance reform laws. In 2010, any individual could donate an unlimited amount to any state or municipal candidate, but now the amount is capped at only $5,000. Well, that leaves me out and you and almost everybody listening to me. It's a country that's bought and paid for. Trump and Jobs donated $50,000 while Spielberg forked over $75,000 and Rubin gave $10,000. Sorkin ponied up $10,000 and Sean Parker, the creator of Napster, played by Timberlake in Sorkin's blockbuster The Social Network, donated $100,000. Record executive Giffen also gave $100,000 and Katzenberg wrote a check for $25,000. Gee, Katzenberg, could you afford it, buddy, with your billions? A political review of financial disclosure documents posted on the Illinois Board of Elections website late Thursday night reveals that nearly 24 donors cut one-time 6-figure checks for Emanuel before 2011. By the way, for those of you who don't understand, a 6-figure check is a check that is $100,000 or above. And how many did he get there? 24 for more than 100,000. The high ticket contributors range from a homemaker in Winnetka, a neighboring suburb, to where Emanuel spent much of his adolescence to Hollywood agent John Fogelman, who works for the agency where Emmanuel's brother Ari is CEO. Well, isn't that interesting? Corruption goes on. The CEO of Fox Family Network, Chaim Saban, another Jew, gave two separate times within a period of 4 days in November, with the first donation being 30,000 Jewish dollars and the second 100,000 Jewish dollars. Oh, did I say Jewish too much? I'm sorry. Shame on me. I didn't mean to do that. Here, let me slap myself. The CEOs of BlackRock, Abbott, Chevron, Walgreens, and Windmark gave thousands. Warren Buffett's daughter, Susan, also gave, as did News Corporation COO Charles Casey, who donated $1,000. James Clark, founder of Netscape, who lives in Palm Beach and was listed as retired on their official disclosures, was a member of the $100,000 club. Way to go, guy. While the names of business pioneer stars and Obama administration regulars stood out in a hundreds-page-long list, former White House Social Secretary Desiree Rogers chipped in $5,000 and OMB top staffer Jeff Zients gave $10,000. Famous Chicago families still played a primary role in boosting Emmanuel's historic hall. The Pritzkers, the Crowns, long known in the area not just for their family holdings but also their political involvement, gave in the six figures. The Pritzkers have given $201,998 to Emmanuel's campaign, basically a third of the total reported by competitor Carol Mosley Braun's shop in the same pre-New Year fundraising period. The Crowns gave $115,000, and that's not including those associated with the Henry Crown and Company, not bearing the Crown name. The Chicago Mercantile Exchange cut a check for $200,000. Dozens of lawyers from top city law firms, especially Kirkland and Ellis, also gave in the thousands. Local real estate and finance moguls gave $500,000. Do you get the idea, folks? You don't have a country left here. And these rich goons have bought it. They've bought all of it from you. You are just a chump. And now you're going to be stupid enough to go vote, aren't you? You're going to march right out there when we have the election 2 years from now, and you're going to vote like it means something, right? You never learn, do you? You never learn. Oh, my God, you people are so stupid. Even the owner of the famous Chicago deli, Manny's, long claimed as a favorite by top Obama advisor David Axelrod, pitched in $1,000. Within 1 month before Chicago's election, Emmanuel's $11.7 million figure puts him leaps and bounds ahead of the second most successful fundraiser to date, former Daily Aid and Chicago Schools chief Jerry Chico, who has taken in approximately $2.3 million. Carol Mosley Braun, who polls show in second place behind Emmanuel, is expected to have about $800,000 on hand, her campaign said. Well, you see, the Jews always win because they own the banks. They own the banks, and because they own the banks, well, it allows them to own the music companies, the media companies, wherever there's big money. You know, positions in the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. I tell you what. Yeah, just reading that, I mean, all that money from these Jews, mostly, there were some non-Jews there, too. But, you know, these were all these big players who play in finance. They don't work a day in their life. What they do is they gamble, usually with other people's money. They'll get other people to invest with them, and they'll gamble their money. And the way the deal works is the people who invest get a little bit of interest and the huge take on selling it for three or four times what they paid for some properties, then goes to the owner who did nothing. Except use your money at a few percentiles interest to make a fortune for himself. I remember this Harry Arnest, a Jewish guy here in St. Louis. He bought the St. Louis Blues for something like, I think he had just a few thousand dollars of his own, and he borrowed a few million from investors to save the Blues because it was going to go to Saskatoon, which was, you know, I don't think it was really going to go there, but everybody thought it was going to. At any rate, he bought it, and he fixed up this beautiful wooden building called the Arena that had a big, you know, oval roof on it that went back hundreds of years. It was really nice, and everybody was real happy with the situation. And then 10 years later, after he got rid of all his tax breaks on the deal, then he sold it to somebody else for about 4 to 8 times what he paid for it. And the investors got their interest on it, and he walked off with all the big money. In no time, he was buying more sports venues and suckering people to invest with him. And that's the way these guys do it, man. It's called America. You know, you screw these people with money that want to be associated with a sports franchise, like an NFL team or an NHL team. You get people to invest in it. They get all excited, and you wine and dine them and take their money. And you buy it for next to nothing. And then when it's sold, they don't get a big bonus. They just get their, you know, their money back and whatever interest is left that's due them. And the guy who put it together walks off with tens of millions of dollars, maybe $100 million. Yeah, baby, it's America. It's America, and you don't have any say as to what goes on whatsoever. You're just a schmuck. Speaking of money, I need some money. You want to keep this program going, you need to send me some money. You get yourself a you know, computer there and look it up on AmericanUSSR.com or in Jewwatch, and just, you know, send a load of money down here, either to me or to James Stenzel, who has helped me with Jewwatch for several years, and who saved it from going down when the Jews came after Chertov and Mukasey of the Homeland Security and the Department of Justice. Went after me. The FBI, to their credit, investigated me and found that I had done nothing wrong, but the Jews wanted to screw me over anyway, and only because I was able to sell it to James Stenzel before I ever talked to them was able to save that that newspaper. So, you know, the thugs weren't able to get it down there, and it's been you know, very good figures of you know, millions of people going up there every year to read everything on Jewwatch. It's a very well respected website, and I think American USSR is going to be even more popular because it's not about Israel and about the Soviet Union, but it's about America. It's about America and the Soviet Union and how it's become like the Soviet Union, how these Jews have made it that way through their banking and through these Bolsheviks who came back here and are now drinking and enjoying themselves at Brighton Beach, speaking in Russian and laughing at how they killed all those millions of Christians, walked away with hundreds of millions of dollars as oligarchs, and they were able to make a good deal for themselves. And they're doing the same thing right here in America with all their scandalous criminality in the banking system. They're making of criminal products which they sold under false misleading advertising to people who have lost trillions of dollars. And now they've gotten trillions of dollars out of your wallet and mine. Well, you don't need to pay a trillion for me to stay here, but please send me something every month. If it's $5 a month, fine. If it's $20 a month, fine. Whatever it is, come on, open up your little wallet and send it to me. You can find the address at AmericanUSSR.com, and do this. You need to do this. You need to make sure that this particular venue stays open, because the United States is going down, and I'm standing between that and a future in which maybe we'll get things back to normal. Take out your pen and paper, write your check, and send it to me. Frank Weltner, 6937 Bruno Avenue, St. Louis, Missouri, 63139. Frank Weltner, Weltner, 6937 Bruno Avenue, St. Louis, Missouri, 63139.